once again, and welcome to Musings on Sports. Kelly Elbin, along with Bob Bupka. Musings on Sports, where great storytelling is what we do week after week. And this week we have a terrific guest later on in the show with Mike Patrick, a longtime voice of Sunday Night Football for ESPN. Bob, that was a lot of fun. We talked to Mike yesterday, and a lot of great reminiscing from Mike, and a heck of an announcer, heck of a versatile announcer, Bob.
Yeah, and the thing I got a kick out of, he really enjoyed our conversation, his conversation, I should say, with you and I, and that made me feel good. He's very talented, he's very likable, and it's easy to see when you talk to him why he had such a great career.
Yeah, and I would say he's one of the more underrated broadcasters, play-by-play guys. You know, when you think of the likes of Pat Summerall and Jim Nance and Al Michaels, they immediately come to mind. But Mike did it for 19 years, and alongside of Joe Theismann and Paul McGuire for the last, I think, 7 or 8 of those, in an unusual three-man booth that was very effective. But we're going to hear from Mike later on. Last week, John Rahm, tremendous effort over the weekend in particular, his sheer strength, and boy, the field gave everything they could at him, but he just was a little too much. I know you've got some stories, not so much about what John did over the weekend, but some great stories related to the LA Open.
Well, one thing on John Rahm, since the beginning of the year, he has defeated 607 PGA Tour pros. So just goes to show you how dominant he is. But I have an interesting story concerning the LA Open. In 1998, they couldn't hold it at Riviera because the Senior Open was going to be held there. So they were going to go down the road to Valencia. And prior to that, there was a tour championship out in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I went to that tour championship. I got to meet the head of Oral Roberts University, a fellow by the name of Rich Roberts. We had a meeting on Wednesday, and the last thing I said to Rich, well, who's going to win the tour championship this year? And Rich, without batting an eyelash, he said, none other than Billy Mayfair. I said, Rich, Billy Mayfair? These are the top 30 players in the world. And I said, by the way, didn't you play with Billy Mayfair in the Pro-Am? He said, I did. I said, what did you shoot? He said, I shot 70. What did Billy shoot? He shot 72. So, Rich, golly, now you're telling me he's going to win. Well, lo and behold, come Saturday, who's in the lead? None other than Billy Mayfair. I'm out on the course doing play-by-play, and I see Billy's wife, Tammy, and she was a nervous wreck. He was battling for the lead, and finally I said, Tammy, don't you worry. Billy Mayfair is going to win, and I know that for a fact. And she saw me on Sunday and said, is he still going to win? I said, absolutely. So he wins, and now we flash forward, 1998. We're at Valencia, first day, early in the week. I go in the media center, and all of a sudden I turn around at Kelly, and I see this giant of a man come walking in, giant in many ways, none other than Ernie Banks. And we became such good friends over the next 3 or 4 days. I mean, he was the perfect gentleman. He had so many great stories about baseball. And I felt like I could have spent a month with him. Now he's telling me that he's a big Tiger Woods fan. I said, who are you rooting for this week? Tiger Woods. I said, all right. Now Sunday comes, and lo and behold, there's a playoff between Billy Mayfair and Tiger Woods. Ernie sees me. He said, who's going to win? I said, I'll go make a phone call to Rich Roberts and I'll find out. I duck behind a corner. I wait a minute or two. Then I come back and I said, Ernie, got bad news for you. Billy Mayfair is going to win. He said, Billy Mayfair going to beat Tiger Woods? I said, yes, he is. Well, lo and behold, Tiger Woods in his career, only lost one playoff, and that was in 1998 against Billy Mayfair. I got to tell you, Ernie Banks thought that I could walk on water at that juncture.
Well, some have thought that you could walk on water. Hey, great story. I like that a lot. Not only did Rahm win, but you got to tell me about your experiences with Bernhard Langer. Bernhard Langer at age 65, Bob, wins his 45th PGA Tour Champions title, tying Hale Irwin for the all-time record. As I've mentioned before, I moderate a lot of press conferences during my time at the PGA of America, and I was asked many times, who's the best player you sat next to? Who was the nicest? And immediately, Bernhard Langer was the name I came up with. Total class, always answering questions thoughtfully, but more so, just the way he conducts himself as a professional. He has maintained unbelievable conditioning. Age is truly just a number with him. And for winning the Chubb Classic Sunday, he gets in a tie with Hale. I anticipate it won't take him very long to break that record. You've known Langer going back a few years. He's always struck me, Bob, as just a very straightforward, good man with a tremendous golf game that really hasn't wavered very much, no matter his age.
Yeah, one conversation that sticks in my mind, he had just turned 60 years old. I had covered Bernhard at the Masters quite a few years, and when I saw him when he turned 60, I said, Bernhard, it doesn't look like you put on any weight since you were playing at the Masters. And he said, 2 pounds, Bob. I said, you put on 2 pounds? He said, yes, sir. He said, but it's all muscle.
That sounds like it.
And, what a great guy. I mean, what a shining example for this sport. You want an ambassador? you have Bernhard Langer as good as they come. On the course, off the course, personally, business-wise, and on top of that, just a perfect gentleman, treats everybody with respect. Congratulations, Mr. Langer, on victory number 45. We can't wait to celebrate on Musings. Your victory number 46 would put you one ahead of the all-time great of Hale Irwin. Hale Irwin winning 45 times.
Man, like I said, I don't anticipate it'll take him very long to get that 46th. We're going to hear from Mike Patrick in a minute, and our show is called Musings on Sports. So I want to muse for a minute, Bob. Hearing Mike talk, you know, we introduced him as the voice of Monday night or Sunday night football for all those years. But I really knew Mike much more during his days of calling ACC basketball, college basketball. And it kind of, when he was talking about Jefferson Pilot, which was the company that broadcast ACC games for years, and he did a lot of announcing for them, it kind of just took me back to being a kid, 1975. I was 15 years old, and the ACC tournament at that time, which only featured 7 teams. It was Maryland, Duke, North Carolina, North Carolina State, Virginia, Wake Forest, and Clemson. And I look at the ACC now, and there's so many teams in there, Syracuse and Boston College. I can't even make heads or tails of it. But it really took me back to the ACC tournament at that time, which the winner of that tournament was the only one to advance to the ACC tournament. Or excuse me, to the NCAA tournament. And just being a kid at that time, and the games tipping at noon on a Thursday and being over on Saturday. And it was a really special time looking back at having just unbelievable, great players from NC State and from David Thompson, great players from North Carolina and Duke and so forth. And then I also, I remember a game that he called, that Mike called specifically, which as a Maryland basketball fan for me was a pinnacle. And then to realize what happened a few months later was as tough a blow as you could ever have. February of 1986, University of Maryland went down and played the University of North Carolina at the new Dean Smith Center. And it was a month after they had opened the Dean Smith Center. North Carolina was number one in the country. They were dominant. They were just a powerhouse. And Maryland, with Len Bias, went down there, and they beat them. And Bias scored 35 points. And I can still remember an inbounds pass that he stole and laid in. I can still remember Mike calling that game. And then just a few months later, after Lenny was drafted number 2 overall by the Boston Celtics, he made a mistake and ingested way too much cocaine in his body, and he was dead before 24 hours had passed from his selection. So I think about those times as a basketball fan, a college basketball fan in my youth.
Yeah, absolutely, Len Bias. And one thing I want to note, you said he ingested too much cocaine. I want our listeners to know any cocaine is too much, too much. Don't mess with it. Len Bias was taken from us at a very early age with an amazing talent. Kelly gave you a good description of that remarkable game they played, defeating North Carolina.
A very valid point. I agree with you on that. Bob, it's been nice walking down some memory lane, having to do with Mr. Cub, Len Bias, and ACC basketball. And we're going to hear from Mike Patrick in just a minute, right after this commercial, from our friends at Titleist.
Being number one is earned. And once again, the Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X have earned the trust of the overwhelming majority of players at every level and recorded the most wins across the worldwide professional tours and amateur events. This continued dominance is validation that performance matters when it matters most. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Kelly Elbin and Bob Bupka with you. Bob, we know the voices of Al Michaels and Mike Tirico in calling Sunday Night Football for NBC in recent years. However, before it was Al or Mike, and before it was NBC, it was ESPN that ushered in Sunday Night Football into our waiting homes with our special guest today calling the action from 1987 to 2005. He also was the lead announcer for ESPN on college football primetime, called a ton of NCAA men's basketball games, and did the play-by-play for both the NCAA Women's Division I Basketball Championship and the College World Series for more than a decade. What a career for one of the great guys in broadcasting, the pride of Clarksburg, West Virginia. Mike Patrick, welcome to Musings on Sports.
Well, thank you for that very kind introduction. It sounded like I was very busy.
Yes.
Sounded to me like you were making a lot of money.
Not as much as they are now, but I guess for the time it, it worked out all right.
Hi, Mike. Bob Bupka here. And, as Kelly noted, what a versatile career you had at ESPN. Was that versatility critical as ESPN took on more and more big sports properties during the years you were there?
Yeah, it served me well, but I made a pledge to myself at some point. Somebody mentioned soccer, and I said, I never played soccer, have no interest in soccer. I would be terrible at soccer. So if you want me to do soccer, forget it. I'm not doing it. Same with hockey. I tried to stand up on skates three times. I didn't last more than a second. So I didn't know how hard or how easy it was to do something, and I wasn't going to get caught in that trap. But football, basketball, baseball, I knew how to do that.
So share with us the story behind how you got the Sunday Night Football job.
Well, I was doing, I was the lead announcer for college football, and a man named Steve Bornstein was running ESPN. And fortunately for me, Steve really liked my work. And when we got the contract to start in 1987, he called me and told me about it and said, I want you to be the play-by-play guy. And I said, well, Steve, I love college football. And there was a pause on the end of the line. And he says, you're not that stupid. This is the biggest break of your lifetime. And I went, okay, I understand now. And that's the way that happened. And it was, through his largesse and his comfort with my work that I got the job. And I did it for 19 years. And as with everything I did with ESPN, I had a ball.
Now, the great Mike Patrick joining us on Musings on Sports. Hey, Mike, I want to get into the start of your career in a second, but let's continue with having a ball and doing all the all those years. And you were in a three-man booth, and you don't see very many three-man booth at all today, much less making it work. But it worked for you and Joe Theismann and Paul McGuire pretty much throughout that entire time. Why? Why did the three-man booth work for such an extended period of time?
Well, we all had to be selfless, I think. I felt my job was to set them up to do what they do best. So I tried to be as succinct as I possibly could with my play-by-play description and let them carry the load with their replays and give them time to do this and that. And they were very good about sharing with each other and setting each other up. And we all had a good time together. And I think that was obvious. People would always say, you guys seem to be having so much fun. And we were. But I've got a great story. I think what people forget is the first year, it was me and Roy Firestone and guest analysts from week to week. I wish I could forget about it, but it's burned into my memory. And before the season started, we had to take a trip to Hollywood to see Don Olmeyer, who apparently had stock in the parent company before it became ESPN. And it was sort of a courtesy call because he was big time guy at NBC. So we go out there and Don gave us the tour of the Hollywood Hills and the view of LA and what multimillionaires do with their lives. And at some point he started suggesting who he thought the guest analyst should be. And the first one, he thought Dinah Shore would be perfect. I immediately saw my career flash before my eyes. The second week, he wanted Don Rickles. I then went deaf and blind for the rest of the conversation, thinking, what a hell of a way to end my career. It'll be over in 2 weeks. After I insult Don Rickles and tell Dinah Shore to stop singing. So I'm walking. I don't think I've ever been that depressed in my life. And so we left to head to the car. Steve Bornstein put his arm around my shoulder. He says, don't worry, it'll never happen. So we had Larry Zonka. The first week was Dick Butkus, which was great for me because Butkus is still the best defensive player I ever saw. The trouble was by the time you got a rhythm with somebody in the first game, it was almost over. So then you had to start all over the second week with either Tom Jackson or John Matuszak, who was great. Matuszak was hilarious. We had O.J. Simpson pre all the trouble. So the second year, they decided that didn't work. So Joe Theismann joined, and he and I did like 11 years together before they added Paul for the three-man booth. So that was the way the three-man booth developed and the way Sunday Night Football developed.
That's a great story. Mike Patrick with us on Musings on Sports. Hey, Mike, we're so used to tuning into ESPN now to watch, you know, Monday Night Football or college football, it's such a big part of our lives. But when ESPN got that deal to do the NFL, that was a real breakthrough and a real change from network television to going to cable for the NFL, wasn't it?
It was a sea change. And not necessarily that we were going to do NFL games, but that we got the contract. Mm-hmm. And that made us legitimate in everybody's eyes. We were already doing college football and college basketball. And I think doing it as well as anybody else did. We had great cameramen, great technicians. Everybody busted their rear end to make sure the show was as good as it could be. But when we got the NFL, everybody knows how big the NFL was. And Steve Bornstein once told me, we never negotiated the contract. He walked into the room with a checkbook and said, how much is it this time? And he'd write the check. That was it. It was a done deal. Because we could make money at ESPN by putting all these studio shows together and just put NFL on it, and people would watch, and we could sell commercials for a lot of money. The games we got, and the NFL knew this, we never got good games. Our schedule was horrid. But the ratings were still good because it was the NFL. And it's really what made ESPN. We were now a legitimate player. People had to bid against us to get things like Big Ten basketball and ACC basketball, which I was still doing. They allowed me to do ACC basketball for the Jefferson Pilot, which had the rights up and down the East Coast, because I loved the ACC. I thought it was just the best basketball in the world. So I was doing their games plus working for ESPN.
Mike, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about your days in Jacksonville, where you landed your first opportunity on television locally, and then you did the play-by-play for the Jacksonville Sharks of the World Football League.
Yes.
How about a little bit about the World Football League, and also about calling games for Jacksonville University, the great artist Gilmore, and from what you had hinted to me, something about a story about a job that you turned down to stay in Florida. A lot to look back on in Jacksonville, huh?
It was maybe the best 5 years of my life. I had so much fun. It was so rewarding. The lifestyle was wonderful. My first job was in radio in Somerset, Pennsylvania, where it snowed 9 months out of the year. And I left for Jacksonville. It was I had done a basketball game. I was done at midnight, a high school basketball game. It was 5 degrees and snowing sideways. I got in my car and started driving to Jacksonville and got there in, I don't know, 16 hours. And it was 70 degrees. And I had arrived in heaven. So I was the weekend guy and a reporter for the first year, and then they made me sports director. And I got a call about 3 months after I was sports director. I'd just come in from playing golf, and my clubs were in a corner of the office, and it was from Detroit. And I was making, I think, $18,500 a year. And this guy in Detroit said, I've seen tapes of your work. We want to hire you to do the 5:30, the 6, and the 11. And we have the rights to Tigers baseball, and we'd like you to do that. Well, baseball was my favorite sport. It was the best thing I did as a kid. And I loved baseball. Said, we'll start you off at $85,000. And, you know, that's a big jump from 18.5.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an incremental raise. It's life-changing. And I looked outside, and the sun was shining on the palm tree that was outside my office window. And I said, can I ask you a question? I said, what's the weather like in Detroit right now? And I guess this was the middle of February. He said, it's 5 degrees and it's snowing. And I said, I don't want the job. And he must have thought I was crazy, and everybody I've told this story to thinks I was crazy. But all I ever wanted to do was be happy. And I couldn't have been happier in that moment, looking at the palm tree and knowing I just played golf. And I've never regretted turning that job down, because I was just the happiest person on the face of the earth, and I wasn't going to jeopardize that for money. And then about 6 months later, I got a call from Jacksonville University, and they wanted me to do play-by-play. And I loved radio play-by-play. It was the most challenging thing to me that a play-by-play guy could do, because it was so fast. And I grew up listening to Jack Fleming in West Virginia, and he was the most descriptive radio play-by-play guy I ever heard. And I tried to emulate Jack Fleming, because he gave me such pleasure listening to it. So I was trying to allow people who listen to the game to visualize it as much as they could by how I described the game. It was so hard to do it that way. It was a big challenge, but I loved doing it because I thought that was the right way to do it. And I got to see great games. Even before I was doing it on radio, it was Artis Gilmore's senior season, and I started the year after. They still had great basketball teams, but Artis was gone. On my night off, I went to the Coliseum. They were playing Manhattan, and Manhattan was terrible. But the coaches were friends, and we were leading the nation in scoring. I think it was at that point, it was early in the season, like 122 points a game. They were just awesome. And Manhattan was awful, but they were going to get a big guarantee to come down and run with us and lose by 50, and everybody was going to be happy. They'd get the money that helped their program. We stayed as the nation's leading scorer, blah, blah, blah. Well, this is before the shot clock. So they came down and stalled. Our coach leaped off the bench. You could hear the obscenities across the court. And I was trying to film a feature on inside defense with Artis and a guy named Pembroke Burroughs, who was a 7-footer. They blocked every shot within 10 feet of the basket. So it's 24-6, I think, was the score. And I was the only one filming. It's the only piece of film that existed of it. And we had called a timeout. And that was another thing about doing play-by-play for them. You could say we and us. I love being a homer. And they came out, and Artis was the only defender on that end of the court. The other four guys went to the other end of the court and sat down. So it was Artis against five guys. And the crowd was howling with laughter. And eventually their coach says, "Go get him." Well, Artis blocked about 7 shots and knocked him out of bounds. They finally scored on a 15-foot jump shot that he couldn't get to. And he took it out of bounds through a 94-foot pass. We laid it in for a layup, put the ball on the ground, and sat down again. And it was just awesome to see. And finally they decided, you know, we're going to run with you. And we beat them by 50 anyway. But nobody else had it on film. The station can't find it. It's gone forever. It's in the archives somewhere in a vault somewhere. But it was great. Never saw anything like it.
Well, I'm very excited to have Mike Patrick joining us on Musings on Sports and listening to you. I think we may have something in common that I didn't realize before this interview. I did a play-by-play game for the Philadelphia Bell in Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, cool.
When they were in the World Football League.
Yes, sir.
And, it was on the cheap. We flew out of Philadelphia the night of the game. After the game, got back on the plane, and I saw all the bruises and whatnot that these players had sustained. And I said, golly. I had no idea that the game was as rough as it was, but
oh yeah,
but the World Football League, pretty amazing. You joined ESPN in '82. What was your first play-by-play job for the network?
I really don't remember because I was still working for the ACC, and ESPN was carrying games I did for the ACC, so it all sort of blended together. And I don't remember the first one that was separate. I probably should, but I don't.
Well, at our age, we forgive those type of things, Mike. Don't worry about it.
I can't remember when I got up this morning.
As long as you get up, that's the key.
Yeah, that is, isn't it?
Hey, listen, Mike, the guy that started ESPN, I'm trying to draw back on my memory bank, Rasmussen, is that name?
Yes.
Name ring
yes.
A bell? Well, I was doing an interview with Mr. Rasmussen shortly after ESPN had hit the airwaves, and I remember saying to him, was there any doubt ever in your mind that what you were attempting to do was going to be successful? He said, only once, Bob. He said, I got a call early in the morning from an engineer, and he said, I made a horrible mistake. I played the fourth quarter before I played the third quarter, and I don't know what to do.
Well, I think there were a lot of people that had doubts, especially when you tuned into ESPN and you got 4 hours of billiards followed by 5 hours of rugby football, Australian rules football, which I really enjoyed. I thought it was a great sport, but the studio shows people were really hungry for things like SportsCenter. And I think that's what really made it, sustained it until we could get rights fees to college basketball and college football. It was the studio guys like Chris Berman and Bob Lee who carried the water for so long. And people got used to it, not having to wait for the 6 and 11 o'clock shows in their hometowns. They could turn on ESPN and get scores and stories 24 hours a day, and it caught on quickly and sustained itself.
Mike Patrick, our special guest. Mike, what was the secret sauce to the Sunday night football success you enjoyed working all those years with Joe Theismann and Paul McGuire?
We were friends. I think beyond the talent that they obviously had, everybody knew their place and, you know, was respectful of what the other person had to do. My job was the meat and potatoes of what the play was. And then I would try to draw out as best I could what they would do with a replay. Usually they alternated replays. Sometimes if it was a quarterback centered replay, Joe would do it. If it was something else, Paul would do it. And people forgot, I think, that Paul was not only a kicker for all those years for the Buffalo Bills, that he was starting linebacker for the San Diego Chargers for 3 years. And in college, had played at the Citadel and led the nation in pass receiving. So he was, a multi-talented athlete. And so was Joe. Joe was a terrific runner and a great passer. And if the games got dull and we were very often the voice of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers when they were just terrible. And, you know, when the game's 45-3, your personalities have to start to come out to try to keep people tuned into the game. So if they weren't arguing with each other about the significance of a certain play, I'd goad them into it. So, yeah. You know, we had certain tricks that tried to keep people entertained in blowout games, and we got used to doing blowout games for quite a while.
Well, you did them very well, that's for sure.
Thank you.
But Mike, you mentioned that the quality of the games may not have been the best on the weekly NFL schedule that at ESPN got, but you had a lot of really good games through the years. Were there, for you, calling the play-by-play, any particular game or games or moment that you look back on to go, wow, it was pretty darn cool?
There was a moment before one game, we were in New York, and I never considered, you know, people would ask for autographs or to take a picture in an airport, and I never understood why they wanted my autograph or my picture. I was this kid from West Virginia that did games, you know, big deal. It was just it wasn't any more important than somebody who changed tires for a living or was a waitress in a diner to me. And Joe Namath walks in the booth, sticks out his hand and said, Mike, I'm Joe Namath. And I said, you're introducing yourself to me? Give me a break. You know, this is ridiculous. Yeah. And every once in a while during a game, it would strike you that I'm calling a game with Dan Marino. Who was the greatest pure passer I ever saw. If you needed somebody to throw a football into a mailbox 30 yards downfield, Dan Marino was your guy. Mm-hmm. And I've always contended if he had ever had a running game or a defense, either one, he'd have won 6 Super Bowls.
Yeah.
Because if you had to throw the ball, if it was 3rd and 15 and you needed 16 yards, he could get you 16 yards, no problem.
Well, it's fourth down now, and we got a punt. So my final question, 5 years ago, you retired from ESPN after 35 years with the network. What do you miss the most about not doing it?
I miss the 2.5 or 3 hours of the game. That's it. I don't miss. I worked 70 hours a week for those 35 years. I did not have a social life, even though I've been married 3 times. I told each one of my wives, I said, we won't be able to go to parties because I'm working nights and weekends. We won't have a social life. We won't have friends, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't regret it because that's what I chose. 70 hours a week was 70 hours a week. I had 3 months off in the summer until we did College World Series. That was 2 weeks. So I could trade that off. You know, 3 months in the summer was just great. But I miss the games themselves and the people I worked with. I worked with the best people on the face of the earth. Our cameramen were second to none. The tape guys, the audio guys, the people in the booth, my spotter, our stage manager, my statistician, they were just the best. All they cared about was the end product. Did they do their job to make that game the best they could? That's what I miss. You don't find dedication like that anymore.
Well, you had an incredible career. And on behalf of Kelly Elbin, this is Bob Bupke saying, Mike Patrick, thank you for being on Musings on Sports.
Thank you very much.
The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X are designed to outperform. Created in Titleist R&D laboratories, manufactured in Titleist golf ball plants, and then validated by the best players in the world. These golf balls are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with the new Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X.
Well, Bob, as we led into that interview with Mike, and I hope a lot of people heard, the guy loved what he did behind the mic. He was really good at it. And, boy, he could do a lot of different things, whether Sunday night football, college basketball, college baseball. You talk about a Johnny on the spot. That's who Mike Patrick was.
Yeah, he was. And I'm still deeply in debt because he had so much fun.
Yeah.
I mean, that really is the goal for us, Kelly. If we have a guest on and they enjoy themselves, then we did our job.
Yeah,
right.
And he said something there about just wanting to be happy with what he's done. And I think of Mike Patrick as that type of person. He worked very hard and came across in the way that he announced. Hey, Bob, this was a lot of fun. Look forward to talking with you again next week. And thank all of you for joining us on Musings on Sports.